Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When you apply for a mortgage or a car loan, how does the bank decide whether you receive it? How about a job? Did you get that interview based on your resume or your zip code? And if you commit a petty crime, how is the jail sentence determined? These crucial life decisions used to be made by human beings, but increasingly they're being made by computers using algorithms, mathematical models that were developed behind closed doors. Today's guest, Kathy O'Neill's new book, warns about the power of weapons of math destruction. That's right, math, M-A-T-H, how big data increases inequality and threatens democracy. And it's something we all have to be aware of because we're all subject to the whims of this data. Kathy O'Neill received her PhD from Harvard. After a brief stint in academia, she landed a position at the hedge fund D.E. Shaw in New York. But when she realized it was betting against people's retirement funds, she became deeply disillusioned. So she left Wall Street and became an organizer and facilitator with the Occupy Wall Street movement. Kathy O'Neill is now an evangelist for the cause that is at the heart of her book. And she joins us to talk about it today. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. This is such an interesting topic. We do a lot of shows about privacy and data, but this angle we haven't really heard much about. So first off, let's talk about your background, because it's really important to learn about your background to figure out where you came today, where you are today. So you got your PhD from Harvard. You're a math nerd, a math geek. You landed a position at the hedge fund D.E. Shaw. And tell us about how you became disillusioned with that experience.
Right. So, I mean, look, I'm glad you guys talk a lot about data and privacy, but I think that that's kind of not the right discussion to be having. So that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because the world doesn't wield data to destroy people's lives. You know, the financial crisis wasn't caused by data. The financial crisis was caused by processes we put into place that was fed by data. So those processes are called algorithms. My job was to build those algorithms. In particular, my job was to build algorithms that were going to predict the market, the futures market in my case. I became disillusioned with my specific projects because I started to, you know, especially after the crisis happened in 2007, 2008, and that's when I started a hedge fund, I should mention. I just started in 2007, right as the crisis was hitting. I started to see the market as not such a sanitized sort of artificial mechanism, but I started to see imagine the actual people behind these bets that I was making. So that was my personal story as to why I didn't feel comfortable building these algorithms to try to anticipate how people would basically how they would invest their retirement funds and pension funds. But the larger story of how I became disillusioned from finance in general was that the crisis itself was in a large part fueled by what I call weaponized mathematics, namely those AAA ratings on mortgage-backed securities. You know, they were trusted because people trust mathematics, and they were not questioned because people are intimidated by mathematics. And like, they represented a kind of mathematical promise that the underlying instruments, the mortgage-backed securities, were safe investments. And because people trusted them, they bought these securities, even though the securities were, in fact, toxic. So it was like this – basically, it was like a corrupt practice, but it was being sort of wrapped in this kind of mathematical type of wrapping paper. And I thought of it as like not a fair, an abuse of mathematics, an abuse of people's trust in mathematics. And I was disgusted by it, and I left finance for that reason.
And not only do we trust the math, but we tend not to ask questions about the system because it's so confusing. I mean, we even had people on the show after the crisis who said, yeah, we're still trying to figure out these derivatives and exactly how this works. And seeing The Big Short, the film about that was based on a true story, I think it explains it really well about what really went on behind the scenes.
Yeah, and I think The Big Short's an important story. I personally am dissatisfied with it in the sense that like those people are not heroes, because at the end of the day, they made a lot of money off of corruption. But the important thing to realize that it does get right in that movie is that this was not an act of God. It was not an act of nature. And like so many people, as it was happening, were saying, oh, this is, you know, black swan event. Like we could never have seen this coming. That's not true. We actually could see this coming. It was because we happened, because at least for the people in the know, which was quite a few people, by the way, we knew that these AAA ratings were false. We knew that the kinds of mortgages that we were rating were new, and they were much more shaky and fragile as bets than anything we'd ever seen in the past. So there was plenty of reason to understand that this stuff was failing. But I think the most important thing to realize is that the fact that it failed in such a spectacular way is kind of a good thing in this weird way. So let me explain. It's a good thing for things to fail and be noticed. What we had was a bunch of lies piled on lies, piled on more lies, and it created this ridiculous housing bubble. And then everything failed in a spectacular way. The entire world's economy stopped. And obviously, there was a terrible amount of fallout from that. And I'm not saying in any sense that was good. But what was good about it was that the lies had to stop. And so I want to contrast that with what happened after I left finance. I went into data science, became a data scientist in the hopes to use my mathematical skills and my model, my algorithm building skills in a way to improve the world rather than to further destroy it. And what I found was like all sorts of other ways that people were sort of creating mathematical weapons, weaponizing mathematics, basically building new kinds of systems and saying, don't look into this because it's math and you're going to trust math and you're going to be confused by math. So just trust us when we say these things are safe and they're powerful, they're secret. And in this case, in the new version of this, which wasn't in the financial markets, but rather in the world of data science, where we're predicting people and not markets, and we're choosing, like we're making decisions about people's lives, there's failure here too, but it's not explosive failure. It's not failure that people are going to sit up and notice, that the entire world's economy is going to wait for us to sort this out. This is kind of a failure that's happening invisibly and is happening all the time, and no one is noticing. And that's one of the reasons I had to write the book.
I think the example you share about the value-added model for teachers really helps us explain and understand how this works. So talk a little bit about this. This value-added model for teachers is widespread. It's a widespread education reform algorithm. You point out that people in Washington, D.C. got fired based on bad value-added model scores. The Chicago teacher strike was about how much the value-added model could be used in assessing teachers. So this is VAM, V-A-M, and it's supposed to hold teachers accountable for good teaching. Tell us what happened when your friend who runs a math and science high school in New York wanted to understand more about this.
Yeah, it's a really important example because it is a very good example of a weaponized mathematics. So my friend is a principal of a public school in New York, and her teachers were getting these numbers, you know, these value-added model scores that were supposed to sort of tell them whether they were good teachers or not. They were numbers between 0 and 100, and they would just get this number with no explanation, no suggestion or feedback as to how to make their scores go up or anything. And when she asked her Department of Education contact for an explanation of those numbers, they actually said to her, "This is math. You wouldn't be able to understand it." And she talked to me about it, and I said, "That's not good enough. You know, the mathematics is not meant to confuse, intimidate. Mathematics, in its, you know, ideally, is meant to clarify." You know, the funny thing about, if you don't mind me going on a short segue, like the funny thing about mathematics is that mathematicians, you know, they only choose notation and just definitions in order to clarify things. So the notation is something that's like shorthand for some very, very precise mathematical concept. We would never use notation that is not precisely defined because it wouldn't be useful. But what happens is people who don't understand notation or who want to use it to intimidate other people will turn around and use this notation in ways to make people feel like insecure and like they're not expert enough to push back on things because it's somehow fancy and mathematical. And this is kind of a huge betrayal of trust in mathematics. But going back to the teacher value added model, here's what it is. It's a statistical test for teachers that's supposed to tell them whether they're good teachers or not. It's based entirely on the scores of their students. And again, there's no explanation for the score. There's no real feedback about how to get better score. But in spite of all that, it's being used in high stakes situations, like you mentioned in Washington, D.C. I think the statistical problem with it, besides the fact that we don't really understand what it's supposed to be measuring, is that it's just simply not consistent. So I interviewed someone named Tim Clifford, who is a 26-year veteran middle school teacher in English in New York City. He got a 6 out of 100 the first time he got a value-added model score. And the next year, he got a 96 out of 100. So the first year, he felt ashamed of his own teaching, even though he'd been teaching forever and he had all these teaching awards. The next year, he was like, "Oh, so I'm a wonderful teacher. Like, what is going on?"
And you write that no teacher gets to understand their score. They can't improve their score. I mean, this is really amazing because a couple of years ago, we were talking about teacher scores constantly in the media. So why didn't anyone say, "Well, wait a minute, can you tell us what this model is based on? Who actually came up with this model in the first place?"
Yeah, so I looked into it myself because I was wondering those very questions. And so I had some reason to believe that I would be able to actually figure this out. And this is why I thought so. The New York Post, and actually I think there's also a newspaper in Los Angeles that did this, they filed Freedom of Information Act requests, which is a typical thing to do. And they asked for all the teachers' names and their scores in New York City. And they got them. And then they published them, and it was kind of an act of shaming those teachers who got bad scores. And it was a vile act, actually. But what it showed me was, you know, okay, we have access to this information because, after all, these are civil servants and these are people that are being scored, so we should have access to this methodology as well as the scores. I figured if the New York Post could get the scores, I should be able to get the formulas for those scores. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request myself. But it was denied. I asked for the source code, to be precise. I asked for the actual computer code that calculated these scores, and I didn't get what I wanted. I got denied my request, and then I eventually found someone who actually built this scoring system, and that person worked at the Value Added Research Center in Madison, Wisconsin. And they explained to me that not only would I never get this formula, but nobody in the Department of Education in New York City would ever get access to this formula either, because by contract between the city and the Value-Added Research Center, it was a secret sauce. It was a proprietary code that no one had access to. So not only could I not explain these teacher scores, not only could my friend the principal not explain them to her teachers, but literally no one in the Department of Education could really understand these teacher scores. And yet they were being offered up as one of the tools in deciding whether a teacher would get tenure or not.
So we're talking about accountability for teachers, but no accountability for the model. How widespread is this across the country? When we're talking about teachers.
That's exactly right. Where's the accountability when it comes to the accountability metric, right? The answer is it's widespread. The Economist a couple years ago drew a map. The Economist really liked this idea, I should add, and because they thought of it as a silver bullet for like fixing the achievement gap problem in the United States and fixing education. It's been really heralded as some kind of absolutely wonderful concept. And it was being picked up by more and more states. And at the time, maybe I think it was in 2014, they had a map with 26 states were using it at some level, which is to say it could be simply in a certain urban school district, because it's much more concentrated in urban school districts than statewide. New York City was using it for many years, and then New York State started using it. And more recently, I should mention, New York State has suspended using it, at least for high stakes decisions, and their excuse right now is that they're getting used to the Common Core and they might pick it up again later. But yeah, it's in widespread use.
So this is a model used for teachers. Are similar models used for people who try to get mortgages or jobs, or is a similar model used when a jail sentence is determined?
Well, I won't say exactly similar, because mathematically I think there are slightly different setups. But absolutely, scoring systems, scoring systems are being used for all those decisions. And they have commonalities with this situation, which we just described with the teachers. And the commonalities are that they're widespread. They have very important decisions, but they're also very secret. And when something like that is secret, You have no, the people who are scored have no appeal. They have no way to appeal their scores. They often don't even know they're being scored. So they have no, you know, no access to their score. So how can they possibly appeal to that score, appeal that score if they have, they don't even know what it is? At least the teachers knew what their scores were. But we often don't know what our scores are in many of these situations. And there's, and moreover, you know, when you have secrecy, you have a lack of accountability. So these scoring systems are being made, but they're not in any sense being audited for fairness or meaning or like even legality in some cases.
Today,
and finally, they are, sorry to interrupt, but finally, they're all destructive. The ones that I write in my book, the weapons of math destruction are actually the algorithms that are secret, they're widespread, and they're destructive.
And again, these models determine who should get hired, who should get into college, how long should someone go to jail. And Kathy O'Neill writes about this in her new book, Weapons of Math Destruction. That's math, M-A-T-H. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. We do a lot of shows about big data and privacy, but we don't focus on these models. Kathy says that they reinforce systems where the poor and people of color often don't make the cut. So what questions do you have about these models? If you've ever found out about data having a significant effect on your life or someone you know, we'd love to hear from you. If you work for a company or an organization that uses algorithms or mathematical models to make decisions, we'd love to hear your story. What are your thoughts on the concerns and the information that Kathy is bringing to the table? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Tweet us at Your Call Radio or leave a comment on our website. So, Kathy, a lot of these decisions used to be made by humans. At what point was the switch made?
Well, yeah, and I do want to mention, like, before I go on, that I am not anti-data. A lot of these decisions used to be made by humans, and they were hugely flawed, right? Mm. We have plenty of evidence, and we're going to talk about, the Justice Department and how the justice system, I should say, and how algorithms are infiltrating sentencing and bail and parole, and for that matter, policing. And one of the reasons that they have been introduced is because we have so much evidence that the justice system is racist, and that judges make very racist sentencing decisions. And so the goal was to improve and to make more scientific and objective these sentencing decisions. And the flaw in reasoning was that as soon as you throw in an algorithm, as soon as you throw in something that's mathematical in nature, it is automatically fair and objective. That is just simply not true, as we've learned more recently. ProPublica has done recently done a study that actually audits one of the recidivism risk algorithms that's in wide use called the COMPASS model, and has found exactly what I was fearing when I wrote the book, namely that blacks are much more likely to get high risk scores, and which leads to higher sentences, and then still not actually end up back in prison later. So people are being judged basically by their race, their demography, like where they grew up, where they live, and their class, rather than necessarily their behavior. And that sort of gives you something that's perhaps highly efficient and highly accurate as an algorithm, but it's not fair, and it's actually probably unconstitutional in many cases.
Can you tell us more about that? What specific systems are using this, coming up with this data, and resulting in very biased information? Tell us exactly how that works.
Right. Sure. I'll talk about predictive policing, because it actually feeds the kind of problems we see in predictive policing actually feed into the downstream questions of, like, sentencing and bail and parole. So the predictive policing algorithms it's a simple idea. And I should mention that algorithms are just pattern matching things. So algorithms take in data, and then they take in something they're looking for, like some definition of success or definition of failure. In this case, it's an arrest. So that's the definition of failure. And it looks for patterns in past historical data that would suggest that is associated with that thing that you're looking for, the arrest. So predictive policing basically says, take in all the arrest data and predict where more arrests are going to be made, and send police to those places. And there's basically, it's most often done with respect to location. So basically, just think about it. Think of a map of previous arrests, and then send that to a mathematical algorithm and say, based on this data, where would you send police to look for more arrests, to look for more crime? Now, I'm kind of being careful with the words I use. I'm distinguishing between crime and arrests because they're really, really different. Mm. People get confused by them. They call them crime records. But actually, arrest records are arrest records, and crime records are a very different thing. So to explain that, let me give you a statistic. Whites and blacks smoke pot at essentially the same rate, but blacks are 2 or 3 or 4 or up to 10 times more likely to be arrested for smoking pot as whites, depending on the jurisdiction. So that's a very important point. Those are 2 points, actually. First, that blacks are much more likely to be arrested. So there's a bias in the data for that crime of smoking pot, if it is a crime. And then the second thing is that it really depends on the way police act in a given precinct, how much more likely blacks are to be arrested for that crime than whites, which is to say that when you talk about arrest records, they are just as much a product of police practices as they are a product of crime. So when you're talking about predictive policing, you're saying the way we talk about it, the vernacular we use is send police to where the crimes are going to occur. But really, you should think of predictive policing as send the police to where they are going to arrest more people. Because essentially, what we're doing is we are codifying our uneven racist police practices that we have in this country due to the broken windows policy. So in New York City, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, in Oakland, we have a policy of sending, sort of have over-policing poor black neighborhoods and arresting people for like nonviolent crime charges. And that biases the data set so much that the predictive policing algorithm just sends police right back to those same neighborhoods. So it creates this feedback loop based on biased data.
Tell us about PredPol. It's a data startup based in Santa Cruz, and this is a predictive program. You write that, like those in the rest of the big data industry, the developers of crime prediction software like PredPol are hurrying to incorporate any information that can boost the accuracy of their models, and these programs are all the rage in budget-strapped police departments across the country.
Yeah, so PredPol does exactly what I just said. Now, I've talked to PredPol. I've talked to Brantingham, who runs PredPol, who's I think the CEO, and we've agreed on the following. We should all distinguish between violent crimes and nonviolent crimes. Violent crimes like murder, assault, rape, those things are not as biased. Like police do not accidentally arrest people for murder, or they don't arrest people for murder in a like racially biased way. So if we had only trying to predict, predict violent crime, that would be a very different kind of data set going into this algorithm than if we predict all kinds of arrest records, if that makes sense. The problem is, of course, that such violent crime like murder and assault and rape, those are much less common. And they're much less predictable. So if you only include that kind of data, you don't have much to go on, and your algorithm isn't so-called quote unquote accurate. So it's like this kind of thing that a balance that a data scientist working at one of these places has to strike, where they want to be able to make claims of accuracy, but they also probably don't want to be accused of racism either. So they have this quandary and I don't really know how they're addressing it right now, but what I'm calling for is a way of actually checking, sort of a kind of not necessarily transparency on their actual code necessarily, but at the very least, although I think we should have transparency on code since this is about justice system, but at the very least, a way of assessing whether what they're doing is racially biased or not. Right now, we don't have that.
Today, I am speaking with Kathy O'Neill about her new book, Weapons of Math Destruction. That's math, how big data increases inequality and threatens democracy. Kathy writes about algorithms. They're mathematical models that reinforce discrimination and punish the downtrodden. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question or idea or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. toll-free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment on the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up next for our special election series of Your Call at 11 o'clock, Senator Mark Leno will be joining us to talk about his 17-year career in city and state government. After 14 years in the legislature, Senator Leno is leaving due to term limits. So if you have questions for Senator Leno, I hope you can join us at 11 o'clock. And then tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of sexism and abortion restrictions in the presidential election, what's getting attention, what's not. The recent video of Donald Trump is getting wall-to-wall coverage. But where is the coverage of the widespread attacks on women's reproductive rights? Back in March, Indiana Governor Mike Pence signed one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. So where is attention about that? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I am speaking with Kathy O'Neill about her new book, Weapons of Math Destruction, that is math, how big data increases inequality and threatens democracy. We've done a lot of shows over the years about big data and privacy, but she says what we really need to focus on are algorithms or computer models that are making decisions for so many important parts of our lives, how we get loans, how much time people spend in jail, how we get jobs. And Kathy has a really interesting background. She received a PhD from Harvard. She worked at a hedge fund, D.E. Shaw, in New York. But when she realized it was betting against people's retirement funds, she became disillusioned. She left Wall Street and became an organizer and facilitator with the Occupy Wall Street movement. And now she's an evangelist for the cause that is at the heart of her book. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, tweet at Your Call Radio, or leave a comment on our website. And let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. 20 years ago, my only good math teacher in college, who wrote a seminal book about math anxiety, which affects women and people of color most, left teaching to work for Wall Street to make these algorithms because he couldn't survive on the money he's being paid. Because the universities are being starved of money and corporatized, and people and students in math and science are being trained to be technocrats to work in industry. Because education is being dehumanized, an issue that feminists and ethnic studies and other people have been protesting. So I see this as nicely dovetailing into the way the education system is being utilized for industry to do these kind of very in service of capitalism.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, what about that, Kathy? Obviously, it depends on what school you go to, but what are your thoughts about how people of color who are affected by these algorithms are understanding math when it's taught pretty badly? I mean, based on what I remember, math wasn't taught very well in my school.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely true. The entire sort of case for these algorithms, and especially the secrecy and lack of accountability, rests on people's fear of mathematics, which is sadly a direct product of the education system that they're meant to be improving. And I should mention, going along with the story that the caller just said, that, you know, as I said, the third characteristic of a weapon of mass destruction, which the teacher value-added model is that it's destructive. But I find that when I say destructive, I typically mean for the individual teacher who's being scored badly and gets fired, which I did find examples of, more than 200 in the Washington, D.C. area. But it also is destructive in a larger sense. Like, it sets out to to solve a problem, which it doesn't solve. In this case, the problem is, you know, the achievement gap in education, or getting rid of bad teachers, more precisely, the way they're framing it. But it doesn't solve that problem. It doesn't get rid of bad teachers. It gets rid of good teachers. Good teachers are saying, like, screw this. I have better things to do with my time than working in an arbitrary and punitive regime where I'm underappreciated and, in fact, vilified for doing my best. So at the end of the day, we have a system which is supposed to be improving our educational system, but actually it's led to a national teacher shortage. Because guess what? When you demonize the biggest job in the most commonly held job in the country, namely teachers, then you're going to have a problem recruiting teachers, of course, because people realize, they look at the paint on the wall and they realize they could get more respect and better paid in other places without having these ridiculously secretive, arbitrary scoring systems wielded on them.
You have teacher friends. Since the publication of your book, have you heard from educators who want to bring this information into the classroom?
I've heard from a lot of my teacher friends that they're forming study groups, like book groups, reading my book, which is nice. It's a first step. I'm hoping to talk to like some teacher union officials about this, because one of the things I've kind of not understood is how the teacher unions haven't pushed back more. And my theory is that they themselves are intimidated by the mathematics, and they feel like, you know, somehow it's the word of God itself. And I feel like there's lots of actually pretty direct ways to push back on this stuff, and I would like to help.
You talk about pushing back against a toxic cocktail for democracy. How would you go about arming young people, especially people of color, people who live in poor neighborhoods that are targeted? I mean, not only are they targeted in their neighborhoods physically, but they're also targeted by this data. How would you arm them with this kind of information to let them know what they're up against?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm glad you asked that question, because it's actually, you know, and I don't mean to, I haven't heard your discussions about security and data in the past, but I'll tell you something that bothers me when I hear about it. This idea that we should each arm ourselves, we should educate ourselves and arm ourselves, and like we should go to these great lengths to keep our data secret or private. It's just not good enough, because at the end of the day, the targets here are the most vulnerable among us. They're the people that have are working three jobs and can't possibly spend time educating themselves about these algorithms, and they can't possibly spend the time learning all the technical stuff they would need to look into algorithms and understand them. The truth is, we have to protect people with reasonable laws and anti-discrimination laws in this country. And we have some of those anti-discrimination laws. In some cases, they're relevant but aren't being applied, because I think the regulators in question don't have the technical skills to question algorithms yet. In other cases, they're not updated right now to the big data era. So I'm calling for an update to that. Now, that's not to say I don't want individual people to be aware of these problems. Of course I do. That's why I wrote the book. I just don't want in any sense us to say everybody's responsible for themselves. You know, that's not okay. That's not sufficient. Having said that, like, I do want everyone from now on, when they hear, oh, it's mathematics, you wouldn't understand it, to say, wait, that's not good enough. If it's deciding something about my life, whether I get a job, with how long I go to jail, whether police come to my neighborhood to harass me. If it's an important thing about my life, then I should know how it works. And I demand to know how it works. And I'm sure that an individual might not be able to do this, but if you organize into groups of people who are being targeted by this, that's one of my ideas. I'm asking for a political response. It's not a mathematical response. I'm not asking people to like educate themselves mathematically and become data nerds by any means. I'm saying we have to push back on the political level, saying this is not okay. We need to understand how we're being assessed at our jobs. We have to understand how we are being sent to jail, under what circumstances.
Yeah, such a good point. Well, thank you for calling in, Lisa. Let's go next to Gary in San Francisco. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to point out something which, as far as I can tell, hasn't been discussed, but which I think is very important, and that is that similar things are being done in some states with private entities providing computer methods of tabulating votes. And from what I understand, there is no way of checking up on this. There's no paper record, and the companies, again, refuse to make obvious their methods of doing this. And this is something which is going to show up in this election in some states. And I think it's exceedingly dangerous. The other thing I'd like to point out is that the thing that goes along with all of this is the increasing tendency of what we call privatization. More and more government is passing off its duties and responsibilities to private companies, and the results are increasing inequality and a breakdown in the general sense of overall community in the country.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Gary. Do you want to take the first part of Gary's comment?
Yeah. So I think what Gary's referring to is the fact that the voting machines are not open source, mm-hmm. Which is to say they follow some algorithm, but we don't understand it, and they refuse to explain it. Now, I agree with Gary that's stupid. But I would like to explain the reasoning there, and then I would like to puncture the reasoning there. The reasoning is that if you explain how you do something, then people can game your system. They can game it. And so they're afraid that, you know, hackers will come in and game the voting machines and decide how to make the votes look. And it's kind of true, because there are hackers that would try to do that. But at the same time, the general consensus is that if you keep stuff open source, the mistakes are found much more quickly and much more easily, because more people have access to it. And there are probably more people. There's at least one person who will find a mistake and will call attention to it so it can be fixed, versus the many people who might find the mistake and try to take advantage of it. I liken it to, I mean, by the way, I should say that reasoning for why all these things are secret, it's a common reasoning across all the algorithms I describe in my book. That's why they're supposed to be secret. That is one of the reasonings, and the other one is, oh, it's our business model, and if we tell you how it works, then it's our secret sauce and we'll lose money. But it's again, it's very flawed, because these are things like very important things about people's lives, like how you're being assessed at your job as a teacher, or how you're being sentenced to prison. And you should know how that works.
Right.
You're not going to game that system. But if you do game that system, that would mean that the system itself needs to be better, because a gameable system is a system that is itself flawed.
And then when it comes to the voting machines, it results in people not trusting the outcome because they don't know how the software works.
And that's probably the most, like, the biggest erosion of the democracy, right, is if we don't even trust our voting system.
Right.
It's ludicrous.
What about Gary's second part about the privatization of these models and these companies that put these models together?
Yeah, it's a real problem, and Gary's absolutely right. Now, I think a lot of people have mentioned to me that, you know, the whole point of the war on teachers is to promote the idea of a privatized version of public school systems, and I think that's probably true. I don't think we even need to go there in terms of criticism, because the statistical flaws of the model are so disgusting and so obvious that we don't even need to make that point. But I think if you wanted to talk about how it actually works for both the policing and the recidivism risk for sentencing and for the teachers, all of these are civil. These are government functions, right? These are things that we as the government pay, as taxpayers, we pay for, and yet they are being done in secret by private companies that are being paid basically as consultants by their governmental agency counterparts, and they are allowed to keep everything secret, which is again the ludicrous. And also, I've talked to quite a few lawyers who understand the Freedom of Information Act law act very well, and they tell me that it actually isn't legal. Those contracts that keep these things secret is not a legal contract. So there's a lot to be pushed on in that arena.
I want you to also talk about something that kept you up at night when you learned about evidence-based sentencing. When someone's found guilty, the judge is asked to think of a recidivism score to decide how long that person goes to jail. And you point out that 22 states use information about whether you finished high school, whether you'll have a job upon leaving prison, whether your father was in jail, for example. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been mentioning it a couple of times because it is such a problematic example. It's called recidivism risk models. And recidivism is like coming back to prison. So your recidivism risk is the risk of coming back to prison. Since 97% of people who go to prison actually eventually leave prison, this is the question, whether they will come back. And here's what happens. And as you said, more than 20 states, judges get these scores when they're deciding on prisoners' bail or parole or sentencing. And in particular with sentencing, if they have high risk versus low risk or medium risk, if they have high risk of recidivism, they are sentenced to jail for longer. So if you just think about that for a second, that means that people are preemptively punished for something they haven't yet done. Now, that's already problematic, but like, let's put that aside for now and just take that as a given. The way these risk scores are actually calculated is also problematic. It's actually very likely to be racist, and in a case that ProPublica has examined already has been proven to be racist. And the reasoning is the follows. This is actually completely clearly racist and classist if you think about it the following way. The two kinds of data that go into these recidivism risk scores are, number one, the arrest records. Now, we already talked about arrest records because they went into the predictive policing algorithm, and they are themselves quite biased because of the uneven policing practices we have in our country. The other kind of data that goes into recidivism risk are questionnaires. And like you mentioned, the questions on those questionnaires are proxies for race and class. They are things like, were you suspended in high school? Do you live in a high crime neighborhood? Do you have a job lined up? These are things that are much easier if you're white and if you're well off to answer the correct way. And as you imagine, like the wrong answer ups your risk score. And the most problematic and horrifying question in that example with the LSIR recidivism risk algorithm is, was your father in prison? I mean, this is something that in open court a judge would rule, like, toss out. If a lawyer stood up and said, "Your Honor, please sentence this man for longer in prison because his father's in prison." I mean, come on, that's unconstitutional. But it's embedded in these so-called scientific risk scores, and the judges use them because they think they are fair and objective in improving their sentencing.
So do you think the best way to deal with this is for state legislatures to take these issues on and pass legislation to prevent this? Is that one of the main ways to tackle this issue?
I mean, if I had the power to do something, I would immediately start auditing these algorithms to explain exactly what they're doing. Because right now, as I said before, like, we have all these algorithms that have been thrown out into the wild in use, right? But we don't know if they're doing anything right. We don't know if they're fair. We don't know if they're legal. We haven't audited them for anything. There is no there's no ground truth against which they can be compared. And so we have for a data person, this is like a very, very sad story, right? We don't have a real data ecosystem. In the world of Amazon, like the Amazon checkout line, there's a real ecosystem of data, right? And I'm not saying Amazon is the best company in the world. I'm just saying they really know how to do their data. So what they do is they show you products. And if you like those products, they're like, oh, people like you like those products. If you don't like those products, they'll say, oh, I made a mistake. People like you don't like those products. In other words, they have a feedback loop, and they see what works, they see what doesn't, and they update their algorithm to make it work better. Whereas what we see here with these algorithms with like recidivism risk, it's the opposite, right? What happens to a person with a high risk score? They're high risk score not because of what they necessarily did or what they're going to do, but because they were born in the wrong neighborhood with the wrong color skin, right? They get a high risk score. They go to prison for longer. Going to prison for longer makes you less able to establish a life outside of prison. And so you have less wealth, you have less connection to your community, you have less chance of finding a job, and then you end up back in prison. So it's actually creating a negative feedback loop, a destructive feedback loop. It's creating its own reality and making things worse, not better.
Kathy O'Neill is author of Weapons of Mass Destruction, that's math, how big data increases inequality and threatens democracy. And let's go next to Amata in San Francisco. Hi, Amata. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? So I'm a big data person as well. I run a startup more focused with big data in the healthcare industry. And I guess one of the things that I wanted to make comments on is talking about whether algorithms are fair or whatnot. I think that's really dangerous as someone who deals with data to apply FAIR, right? Because part of these algorithms are built upon garbage in, garbage out. The question itself can lead to, I would say, confounding or, you know, systematic error or bias within findings, because the questions that are being asked, like where is crime or, in your earlier example, arrest happening, then you're going to look for those things. As a means to educate others to be more aware, I don't think people need to be scared of math, scared of data. I think, if anything, people just need to understand, okay, if this is what this is being based on, what other factors can we add into? What other data sets can we put in to maybe make the algorithm close or model closer to reality? I think I've just been concerned listening to the comment so far, is it's, at least I feel it's a lot of this, okay, data and algorithms can be used in a bad way, but, or for, to, you know, emphasize system, institutional racism, but I think to sort of apply a moralistic or even fairness onto an algorithm in and of itself is, it's weird, and it makes me uncomfortable as someone who deals with data.
All right, Amata, let's get Kathy to respond and stay on the line in case you'd like to jump in. Kathy, what are your thoughts?
I'm so glad Amata called. I mean, because this, I mean, Amata, like, I'm sorry, but Amato. I'm going to have to go. Amato, sorry. Amato, I, you know, here's the thing. We always have morals as embedded in our algorithms. That's the way we build them. So the discomfort you're feeling, I'm glad you're feeling it, because it's like, for me, it's progress. There is a concept of fairness. We have it as a society, and we have these algorithms, and they're either fair or not fair. I'm not saying it's easy to define fair. It's actually quite hard to define fair. But the idea that we have somehow transcended the concept of morality or judgment or fairness, that is the problem. That is the problem that I face in the data science community, because people like to think of what they do as science rather than anything to do with fairness. But in fact, it since it affects people, it has to be seen through the lens of fairness. That is just a fact.
I guess your issue of fairness, I mean, I deal with data in the public health space. So one of the big issues we always see is confounding, whether it's positive or negative confounding, and that's typically brought in by the question being asked. And I think a way to make things even more objective is in these different studies, let's say, again, going back to either your study on arrests and predictive policing, is outside of, okay, here is where arrest records occur. I think when people then ask questions like, as you were alluding to earlier, of did the subject's father get arrested, et cetera, those are, you know, other confounding variables that shouldn't really be in the algorithm in itself.
We're almost out of time. Let's get Kathy to respond.
Yeah, so I talked to someone who builds recidivism risk algorithms, like, anonymously, and I said, well, do you ever use race in your algorithm? And he said, oh, no, I wouldn't do that because that would end up with racist outcomes. And I said, well, do you ever use zip code? And he said, oh, yes, I do use zip code because it makes it much more accurate. And I was like, well, zip code in a segregated society is a proxy for race. So, I mean, I just found the reasoning, the ethical reasoning of data scientists who work at this stuff is very, very crude. It's like they simply don't want to consider the way their algorithms actually end up, like the consequences of their algorithms on the actual people that are targeted by it. And for the most part, they get to hold that at arm's length, because I have to say, like, you know, as a technologist, as a white educated woman living in New York City, these algorithms do not punish me, but I do set these algorithms up that punish other people. And so the question is, do I empathize with those people? Do I consider the consequences of my algorithms on the most vulnerable among us? I mean, that's how I've chosen to do it. And that's what ethics really is. And I think one of the things I'm calling for at the end of the book is for data scientists to start taking their ethical responsibilities much more seriously.
Well, thank you for calling, Amato, and sorry to cut you off there, but we're almost out of time. Can you elaborate on that, Kathy? We've got about 2 minutes left. You write that, you know, at the end of the day, this is not a question of privacy because, you know, minimum wage workers, people of color, often don't have a right to privacy. This is really about social justice.
Yeah, so I mean, most of the algorithms I'm talking about are not online. You know, some of them are, like the tailored ads, which give me opportunities to buy luxury yarns because I'm a huge knitter, but which prey upon poor young people because they are targets for for-profit colleges and payday loans. So that's an example where privacy issues are important. Like, and if we had privacy laws like they do in Europe, we would probably see less of this kind of predatory targeting. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these algorithms have to do don't have to do with privacy. Privacy at all, because they have to do with like applying for a job. And guess what? When you're applying for a job and you need that job, you will answer the questions asked of you. Or if you're being sentenced to prison, then you don't have any concept of privacy. Or if you're a teacher, you know, the data that's being collected about you as a teacher, again, is not something you can fight against. So really what I'm thinking about when I think about algorithms is they're tools of social control. And the people who are in power have the control, they have the data, they have the data scientists. And they can package all this stuff not as a micromanaging, unfair tool of social control, but they package it as like mathematical and therefore objective and fair. And there's no reason to believe it is either of those things.
And just briefly, have you heard from anyone who creates these models who said, okay, maybe I need to make some changes here?
Absolutely. I'm hearing from all sorts of people who, especially data scientists, who are very seriously looking at the book. They're having study groups thinking about it. I haven't heard from anyone from Google or Facebook yet. I'm still waiting on that.
Well, we got an email from Jackie who says, thank you. I'm going to tell my teacher union leader friends about this book. Kathy O'Neill is the author of Weapons of Math Destruction. That's math. When she landed a position at the hedge fund D.E. Shaw in New York, she became disillusioned, learning that it was betting against people's retirement funds. So she became an organizer with the Occupy Wall Street movement, and now she's an evangelist for this cause. Kathy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of sexism and abortion restrictions in the presidential election. The recent video of Donald Trump boasting about sexual assault has become the defining moment of the presidential race. But where is coverage of the widespread attacks on women's reproductive rights? In March, Indiana Governor Mike Pence signed one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. Join us at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.